Welcome to KABU, Dr. Kaylee Simmons, Assistant Professor of Indigenous Nations Studies at Portland State University and scholar focused on representations of Native peoples in popular culture, including in the genre of horror. It's delightful to have you on the Omol Variety Hour today to talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, certainly a horror story based on history. The new feature film directed by Martin Scorsese, based on the 2017 book of the same title by David Gran. The film recounts the horrific story of the Reign of Terror in 1920s Oklahoma, a bloody chapter in American history when dozens of Osage natives were murdered in a conspiracy by white settlers to steal the oil-rich land underneath their feet. Kaylee Simmons, let's start with you talking a bit about your own work and how you approach a film like this, your own criteria for evaluating Killers of the Flower Moon as a film project.
Yeah, Wopila, thanks for having me. Kaylee Simmons, Amachiaki, Oyate, Mithawa, Ogallala Lakota. Hi, I'm Kaylee Simmons. I'm Ogallala Lakota. Like you said, I work at Portland State University. And I guess I want to start off by sort of foregrounding that my view of the film comes from my experience as a scholar of Indigenous film history. So thinking about how Native people have been represented and represented themselves in cinema for 100 years. And I think I'd be remiss not to start off by sort of pointing people in the direction of some Osage voices first. There's been a lot of responses to this film, and I want to make sure that in these conversations that the Osage voices don't get buried, because I think they are the ones that we should be centering. So there's a really great review of the film by a wonderful Osage scholar named Jean Dennison that just came out in Time magazine. There is a really wonderful article by Joel Robinson that was in Slate, who is also Osage. There's a really wonderful piece by amazing field-defining Osage scholar Robert Warrior, who's Osage and sort of helped start the Native American Studies Association here in North America. And then also, if we're thinking locally, Cindy Lou Coleman, who we wanted to have on the show but couldn't for scheduling reasons, who's also Osage and lives and works in Portland, has also published a piece on her personal blog that's called Native Science.
And she also is coming on to the Omol Variety Hour in November.
Yeah. So I'd say, you know, make sure to seek out Osage voices. There's a diversity of opinions on it. And there's a diversity of broader Indigenous opinions on the film, as we're seeing. So that's sort of how I want to ground my response to it, is as a person who studied the trends in Indigenous representation since Native people started appearing in film, which is basically within the origins of film. Some of the first short films created by the Edison Company were recordings of traditional Indigenous dances. So basically, as soon as movies have been made, Indigenous peoples have been in the movies with varying degrees of equitable and fair representational practices.
You smile. And of course, one area of your scholarship is ethnography. So you've been interested in attempts, including perhaps Scorsese's attempts, to bring some ethnographic validity to the representations of those Osage people. You want to continue on in that direction, because Scorsese has been praised for bringing his team into extensive consultation in the Osage community, and aiming for a level of authenticity that he feels is a corrective to the distorted place that Native people have in the film imaginary and popular culture. Mm-hmm. Do you want to begin with that aspect of the film that's been both praised and criticized on that front?
Yeah. So to sort of paint a broad picture of Indigenous representation in cinema. One of the earliest examples of Native sort of ethnographic cinema is a film like Nanook of the North, which was made in the 1920s by Robert Flaherty. It's largely discussed as a documentary, but if you look further into the history of that film, you realize that so-called Nanook, that's not the name of a person, was a character played by Inuit man named Alok Arialok, and that behind the scenes, even though Flaherty was claiming he was the kind of auteur, that Inuit people were consulting with him on storyboarding that film, they were operating the camera, they were guiding him right to different shots. So this structure of consultation with Native tribes is a longstanding technique that filmmakers have participated in when they've been making movies about Indigenous peoples. It's gotten better in terms of the transparency around consultation, right? Robert Flaherty did consultation, but then, you know, didn't really tell us about it when he made the film. And I think that in terms of Scorsese's approach to it, you know, consulting with tribes, hiring folks within the community to design costumes and props, you know, infusing the local economy in that way, working with language consultants. I think one of the really compelling elements of the film that I found was the use of the Osage language. I think it was treated like the way any other language would be treated in film, because I think oftentimes Indigenous language gets sort of exoticized. The long history of Indigenous representation in cinema, oftentimes, you know, Native languages will go untranslated, or there's to some hilarious ends instances where the Native actors would be speaking and saying one thing in their Native language, and it would get translated to something else. There's a very famous clip, if you watch the film Real Injun, there's a scene where they have some Native actors speaking, I believe it was Navajo, and they're basically making fun of the whole movie, but what gets translated is not what they're saying. So I think there are a lot of admirable qualities to Scorsese's approach. I think the film was, you know, beautifully shot. The sound design was amazing. You know, it's a high production value film, and it is a prominent place for a lot of Indigenous craftsmanship to get, you know, showcased. I think Lily Gladstone killed it. And if she doesn't, you know, get an Oscar for this, I'll take to the streets. But
can you say a little bit about her character of Molly and about the drama, which is in part love affair and part a story of betrayal and corruption and violence, and where she's kind of caught in the embrace of a man who's destroying her. So it has this real tragic unfolding horror to it. Can you say a bit about her character and the relationship with Ernest Burkhart, which is basically the central drama of this story, as I understood it?
Just to clarify too, I believe Lily uses she and they pronouns, or they and she pronouns. So I'll try to use both. So Lily portrays the character of Molly Burkhart. The way that the film is set up is that it kind of focuses on the character of Ernest Burkhart, who in real life, you know, married into the Osage community, and then proceeded to systematically kill all of the people around Molly, her family, her sisters, and then attempt to kill Molly herself in a scheme to inherit the head rights to the oil land that she, you know, owned. Also, Lily, you know, is had been deemed incompetent, meaning that she was incapable of managing her own finances. And so in some ways it was advantageous for her to enter into a relationship with Ernest, because then she, you know, she didn't have to have someone to look out for her money. Ernest could, her husband could be the kind of one that could facilitate that. She didn't have to go to like a third party. As much as, you know, marrying a horrible, murderous, lying bastard can be, right? Her portrayal was just, Lily's portrayal, what they brought to that character was just so strong and generous and compassionate. And they do this in many of their other roles. She has also portrayed beautiful characters in Reservation Dogs. And I was glad to see that Scorsese noted that, you know, once he started consulting with the Osage, he had kind of decided to shift how the narrative was structured. Initially, Leonardo DiCaprio was supposed to play the Jesse Plemons character, who was an FBI agent. And once he talked to the Osage and realized he wanted to kind of ground the story more through their experiences, it made sense to sort of switch to the perspective of Ernest. I think, you know, a lot of people, when we heard that story, were hoping that we would get more insight from the character of Molly. And we do get some voiceovers and we do get some scenes with her. But I think overall, the film still mostly sort of follows the story from the perspective of Ernest, you know, the white character. And so while we get more insight into how the Osage were, you know, responding to this crisis, this genocidal crisis, I think it's still a different movie than if, say, we centered the experiences of Molly and her sisters, and Molly and her family, because there's some things that we don't get to see from Ernest's perspective. And that makes sense because I think he's still kind of an outsider that fully doesn't sort of comprehend what's going on with the Osage.
Do you think the film is too empathizing with the character? Of course, Leonardo DiCaprio is a captivating actor and probably a big budget item in this film, along with Robert De Niro. But his moral unfolding at times drew the audience in ways that felt it was a bit too forgiving of him. And of course, you see Molly seemingly blind to him until there's a triumphant moment at the end, at the risk of a spoiler, when she sees him most clearly through the lens of a courtroom scene. But it seemed in the book there was more of Molly's anguish and outrage, and she seemed very much a stoical character. And is there a You know, that's also a trope or a stereotype of the noble, stoical native who endures the assaults and attacks and kind of occupies a spiritual plane above it all. And I was wondering about your take on that, although of course her character was riveting and kind of the center in many ways of the film and the moral conscience of the film.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be, I think if we wanted to tell a story about this incident from Molly's perspective, I think we would need an Osage director to do that. And so for me, it makes sense that Scorsese sort of grounds this story in this kind of like outsider white guy perspective, in a character that is, you know, morally in the wrong, because a lot of his films sort of are exploring the psyche, like how do these people become who they are? How do they get caught up in these kinds of, like, you know, to quote Psycho, these like personal traps, right? These personal mazes of their own building. And so for me, it makes sense that Scorsese, you know, grounds the film in this perspective, because I think it's, for lack of a better term, it's like one of the more ethical choices that he could have made. I think if he were trying to direct this film from a native perspective, that would be more hazy ethical grounds.
There was this whole
And that.
storytelling rights that people talk about. Who has the right to tell what kind of story?
And I think anyone can tell any story. It's not, we're not talking about the law, but I think, you know, what are, you know, storytelling practices that are attend to the histories and the current conditions that Indigenous people exist in. And I think if there's one thing I want to sort of bring up around this conversation that has kind of exploded about the film, is that I really, really hope people start taking seriously Indigenous directed and written and led stories and supporting those stories. Because when people come out and say, well, no one would have given a Native person $300 million to make a movie about this, they are correct, and they are pointing to deeper structural problems within the film industry, and I think within American culture more broadly, that Indigenous art is not being supported in the way that it needs to be supported, especially if we're moving towards reconciliation and reparation with Indigenous communities. I think there are models for Indigenous filmmaking that exist in all other places. There's a really robust Indigenous filmmaking world in Aotearoa in New Zealand. Way, way up north, there's, really successful Inuit produced films. And so this consultation and kind of collaboration model has been around for a long time. And I think what we see in Killers of the Flower Moon is the kind of like apex of that kind of model. And I think in terms of the problems and the limitations of the film that people are seeing, I think that sort of shows, right, that there are limitations to this model. And if we do want deeper forms of Indigenous storytelling, we need to start really taking seriously funding Indigenous stories and centering Indigenous, voices and creatives, putting Indigenous people in charge of these projects at the highest level.
Yeah, so you're saying there are limits to what Scorsese could do through this film. And I did think the ending was a very profound departure from conventional narrative, certainly the white savior genre that we're familiar with, of who comes in to save the day, or even romantic portrayals of other heroes that resolve a conflict by film's denouement. And instead, we have this a radio play at the end that's also based on history, and a very profound way in which Scorsese himself comes in to honor Molly, the protagonist that's so part of this, central to the history, Molly Kyle, and the ongoing debt to Indigenous people beyond the Osage. Do you want to say anything about that ending?
Yeah.
Without going into too much detail, but that's part of the problem of doing film analysis. Mm-hmm. So much about how our approach to film critique or film analysis depends on how the film resolves the dilemmas it sets up. So we have a dilemma there in how you talk about endings and the phobia around spoilers.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yes. So spoilers, folks familiar with the story will sort of know what happens. It stays pretty, close to the histories of the book. So there's two parts to the ending. The first part is this kind of radio play, which I read as this kind of like self-questioning moment for Scorsese, right? Because it's this all-white cast performing a history of the Reign of Terror, performing a version of the story that we have just watched.
For a white audience.
Yeah. For a white audience, yes. And obviously, Scorsese is aware, right, of this long history of white people either portraying Indigenous peoples or portraying Indigenous stories without being accountable to Indigenous communities in the ways that they ought to. He appears, right, and reads a statement about the resolution of the case, directly addresses the audience. I read that as, this kind of self-reflexive moment of Scorsese saying, did I or did I not just do exactly the thing I wasn't supposed to do? I don't know I appreciate that because I have seen such sort of self-reflexive moments in other places in film history. So I guess I'll leave it at that. But I do think that this is a very self-aware film. And then the second part of the ending is that it cuts to contemporary Osage people at a gathering and slowly zooms out. And I was able to go see the film at the Hollywood Theater. I coordinated a Native community screening. Hollywood was able to donate, 30 tickets to us, and then I funded another 30 tickets. And I was really glad I could see the movie in a theater with a lot of other Native people. And it was also really nerve-wracking because I didn't know what the film was going to be, and I didn't also know if audience members were going to react in ways that were appropriate and responsible to Indigenous people. And I think everyone did a good job. Everyone behaved themselves. But one thing, I was really glad at that ending, that shot of contemporary Osage people, because I was reminded that even though there are these horrific chapters in Osage history and similar chapters in many other Indigenous people's histories, that we're still here. And that we're still in modernity, and we didn't disappear like we were supposed to, right? And we are still all able to occupy the theater together and be together in that way. But then also, as the camera zooms out and you see, more and more sort of green space, you're also reminded that there were supposed to be more of us here, right? We were supposed to fill that theater. And so it was a very important ending. And I think perhaps I'm reading it from an Indigenous angle. I don't know if non-Native viewers had the same thought when they saw that, or if that was also Scorsese's intention to, point out the absence of Indigenous peoples in the face of our, refusal to die, as settler colonialism wants us to do. But yeah, I found the ending of the film thoughtful and self-aware. And again, there are lots of good qualities to the film, but in the end, I am ready for Indigenous stories, and I think a lot of Indigenous folks are also ready for Indigenous stories. And I hope that more people will help support us in telling those stories moving forward.
And Kaylee Simmons, I hope you continue to come on to the Omo Variety Hour to tell those stories and offer commentary and not only praise or applause, but analyses like you've been able to provide today. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Omo Variety Hour. Once again, this is Jan Hawken talking with Dr. Kaylee Simmons, Professor of Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University.
Sent you here to dispose of us as you see fit. If I thought you were sent by the Creator, I might be induced to think you had a right to dispose of me. Do not misunderstand me, but understand me fully with reference to my affection for the land. I never said the land was mine to do with as I choose. The one who has a right to dispose of it is the one who has created it. I claim a right to live on my land and accord you the privilege to return to yours.